Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Do you like Sheffield Live? Why not become a friend of Sheffield Live? Sheffield Live is a community radio station, and friends of Sheffield Live are people in the community who make a regular donation to keep Sheffield Live on the air. Join the Friends of Sheffield Live by writing to friends@sheffieldlive.org or go online to sheffieldlive.org/friends.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to another Deserted Island Disc. It's your weekly radio show that gets people who are born in Ireland and now live in Sheffield. So tonight I've got an amazing guest. She's a very special woman. She's lovely as well, quite chatty. She's worried we're not going to have enough time. We've only got an hour. But it's Yvonne O'Donovan. She's originally from Limerick. Yvonne was made a mark in so many areas. She was in the arts and culture sector. She's deeply committed to that. She made a name in the underground dance music scene, co-founding Modo Records, a label that helped shape a bold new sound and community. Since then, she's gone on to lead to arts and cultural development and coaching, always bring people together and helping them grow. Yvonne has also quietly and powerfully supported grassroots food businesses, working with passionate people at early stages of their journey and helping them grow into thriving, sustainable enterprises. The kind of work nurturing ideas and people from ground up is something she does so well. She's got her own consultancy still, and we'll talk more about that. You've also a mother, and so welcome.
Grandmother.
And grandmother. Welcome, Yvonne. How does that feel, hearing all that?
I was reviewing my patchwork life before coming here tonight, and I became very aware of how fractured and how sort of disjointed it looks. Somebody told me many years ago when I was still a teenager that I was a bit of an outlier and didn't necessarily like follow the herd. And so I think I'd compare, I mean, you make me sound like kind of seamless, like I did this and I did this and I did this. It wasn't great. I think you'll find by the end of the hour that there were a lot of pitfalls and holes I fell into along the way. And I'm happy to share those with your listeners as well. It's kind of, I see it like a patchwork quilt. So each of the squares have come from very different circumstances. So my time in Ireland had a specific shape and style of the times to it. And then I lived in London for 12 years. And then I moved to Sheffield. But at the beginning was doing a lot of international work. And then I bedded myself down here and did local work. And then I went off and did work in Nottingham and other countries. So it's kind of, there isn't a straightforward shape to any of it. It's a bit of a zigzag.
Well, that's like most people, I imagine. And that's what happens, certainly, yeah. I'm an outsider from not from Sheffield, living here now, and very, very similar paths of how people get here. Well, let's take you back to Ireland then. So tell us about, what was your childhood like?
I was born in the late 50s in Limerick by the banks of the Shannon River, largest river in the British Isles. It was to describe my childhood is both a tragic, comic, poor and wealthy. So in other words, it spanned all of that. I was born a month before the death of my only sister. So it was kind of a house that had a lot of sadness in it when I was very young, which when you're a child, you don't realise has nothing to do with you.
Yeah, you don't know what's going
so
on.
So I think somebody said to me years later, I had a nose for pain. And I thought it was an interesting way of describing it, because I think so. I think I can hold difficulty well, and you'll understand that in the end. But in a way, it was very typical late 50s, kind of on the borders between town and country living. My dad was from a tailoring family, and they'd set up a small business. All of my background is small business.
Okay.
My grandmother had been, rumour has it that she was, or her family was Jewish and had come over from Lithuania at the end of the century before. But
Limerick had quite a lot of anti-Semitism at the time, so we were never officially told that. And she spent a lot of her money, as she prospered, buying altar pieces and glass, you know, statues and things for the church. So I don't know whether that's true or not. Oh. But there was certainly a very aspiring and ambitious and, you know, Ireland in the 50s, they'd only been an independent country for 3 decades. Yeah. There was a real appetite for proving yourself, that kind of, you know, driven to succeed. And I think having come out of poverty, I was amazed recently to realise that my mother's family, who were from Tipperary, they were from the Silvermine Mountains, a place called Dalla, very rural. Yeah. My grandfather had gone to the US years before prospecting for gold.
Oh, yeah.
So the story is he went to California and didn't make any. He went to the Yukon and didn't make any. And then he ended up in Montana, where I think he made a bit.
He found some gold in the hills.
And then came back to live in the silver mines. But he married a local convent girl from Nina, and they had 12 children, I think. Most of whom survived. Some of them didn't in those big families.
Yeah.
But my grandmother from that farm had, I have their records going back to the 1700s, that family. And she was 12 when the Irish famine was on in 1840.
Yeah.
So in living memory, they had grandparents who remembered what it was like to be dirt poor.
Did you know your grandparents much?
I knew them until I was in my early teens, but we were, my father was the eldest son, but my mother was second youngest daughter. So they seemed very distant and very old. They're not like grandparents today. You'd go to their houses and you'd wipe your feet and you'd have a sandwich and you'd be told, you know, children in those days were, you know.
Is that not like you're in a house now?
Oh, gosh, no. No, you were kind of scared of your granny and granddad, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
You got a belt quite easily. I mean, it wasn't, I'm not describing it in any kind of trauma, but spare the rod and spoil the child was definitely the norm. So if you did anything wrong, you just get a belt. And so there was an aspiring community, one farming family, their own business, completely sustainable farm.
Yeah,
aside from going and swapping cheese and butter for shoes and clothes, they basically reared that many children without anything except their own labour. It was quite astonishing when you look back. And my dad's family the same. I mean, that company ended up growing and growing and growing and growing until by the time I was in my teens, they were employing hundreds of people. It's called Danis. It's quite well known in Ireland.
Right.
In fact, they have a lovely Facebook group of ex-workers. But so it was a strange background where they'd started out with almost nothing in a little estate where, you know, they were built in the 50s for newly married couples and everybody was the same. So the area was full of children.
Yeah.
They were all Irish Catholic. They had loads of children. So, and we were kind of feral, you know, we were sent out to play after school and we were.
Sounds great. Was it a happy childhood, you say?
Aside from the kind of feeling of sadness in the family from loss,
and
my mother later had several miscarriages, and I think it affected her badly. And in those days, there would have been no grief counselling, and just got on with it. And I think by nature, she loved the soil and the earth. And I always remember she had loads of vegetables planted in the back garden, cabbages and carrots and all sorts, and fruit trees. And the neighbours made her take them all out because they said it made it look like she was a peasant.
Wow.
It was actually not a time.
Yeah.
It was a time when they replaced pine furniture with formica.
Yeah.
And
so is
you
that
know,
kind of,
they kind of aspired to be like the Pan Am adverts.
Yeah. Where away you, from you, that, you, the old country.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But my house was full of music. This is absolutely glorious music because my mother was a radio listener all the time. So the first sound you'd get in the morning when you woke up, which was about 6:45, you had to be ready for the school bus by 8:20. I don't know, you know, all that kind of 60s Lulu and what's her name, Dusty Springfield, you know, all the downtown.
Yeah.
She was very poppy, whereas my dad, who had an amazing ear for music, he was a great piano player. He liked piano concertos, and he liked tunes from the shows like West Side Story and all that. So my life was full of music.
Yeah,
I can't imagine not having music.
Well, knowing what I know, this all links together, doesn't it, to your later life, the things you've mentioned already about businesses, music and agriculture stuff. So we'll hear about that. But we also, I should mention to listeners, we do play music in this. should we play a song, Yvonne? What's your first choice?
My first choice goes right back to my roots. We were not Irish-speaking in my family, but we were shipped off every year to either Spittal in Galway or Ring in Kerry or Ballyferriter and Ballydavid, which anyone who knows the Kerry side of Ireland will recognise, to Irish colleges. So basically your parents got rid of you for a month.
Yeah.
And you were supposed to come back speaking fluent Gaelic, and we giggled and didn't really behave ourselves very well, but you got a real love for it. And of course, that's where all the folk music was, and that's where all the native Irish speakers were. So you learned the rhythms and the stories. So the first song I picked, which is also recorded by Clannad, is Dúlamán, which means a type of seaweed, like bladder wrack or channel wrack.
Here it is. Lovely. That's great. So let's Dúlamán. Is that how I pronouncing it right? Celtic woman.
Dúlamán.
Dúlamán.
The word means seaweed, and it's the practice of gathering it from the shore is what the word means. So it's used for fertilizer and for bathing in, and for food because you can eat it, and for dyeing cloth. So, and there was an old neighbour of my mother's in Liscannor. She bought a house in West Clare when I was a teenager. And he used to collect stuff called slew corn, and we used to eat quite a lot of seaweed. And if you go to the beaches in Ireland in the summer, they sell you bags of seaweed on the side of the shore.
Sounds healthy, isn't it? And it's all the fashion now, seaweed, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's great, yeah.
Long before it was fashionable.
So what were your teenage years like then in Ireland?
Ooh. I suppose it kind of leads into the next tune as well.
Late 50s and early 60s were a very hopeful time, I think, for a lot of the world. They were coming out of the post-war kind of difficulties and challenges, and there was a sense of, there was political hope, you know, there were speeches by John F. Kennedy, and there were civil marches by Martin Luther King, and there was sort of, I don't know, there was a buoyancy in the air that we can begin to make things better. And I suppose my experience was 90% positive. It was enriched like good fertilizer with art and culture and poetry and ritual and pageantry and academic freedom. You know, girls were not treated any different than boys academically. I went to decent schools. I got a great education. I was encouraged to think of myself as able to do anything.
That's great.
And I don't think that would have been true. Like my mother and father, my father left school at 13, my mother at 15 or 16, no qualifications at all. And in fact, I was the first one, I think, to go to university of my family.
Yeah. What do you think had changed then in that generation, and why was it like, oh, there for you and not for your parents?
I think Ireland in the 30s and 40s, if you think about the context of the country, it was just after the Civil War. That was the 20s. That had, broken families and broken. The Northern Ireland had actually gone a bit quiet, certainly in Limerick. It didn't bubble up until later.
Yeah, of course.
They'd gone from hardship to beginning to amass some capital, you know, like my parents being able to get a house. Before that, I was giggling recently about I shouldn't giggle about a subject as awful as the adolescence movie, but they were discussing it in a program, and they used the word incel, and I wasn't sure what it meant, so I looked it up, and it was involuntary celibate. And I thought, the culture I grew up in, almost everyone was involuntary celibate, because unless you were busy having loads of children, they were called spinsters and bachelors, and they just were part of the community and looked after loads of other people's children, or, you know, it was just not a big deal, you know. But there was a sense that the old community bindings that hold people together, there's a guy called MacDonald, I think, or McIntosh, that wrote a book called Soil and Soul, and that's about the Scottish Island communities and how nobody was expected to be perfect. The strong always took care of the weak. You know, if somebody was a bit of an Amadon, which kind of means a fool, and now would be called a learning challenge or a difficult, they would just, it was accepted that they would be looked after.
And part of
the
that
same as, you know, we grew up with, there were a lot of old ladies, because even then I think they in the main lived longer than their partners. And you just automatically, after school, as part of what you did, you popped around to see if so-and-so needed something from the shop, or it wasn't, you didn't even have to think about it. And of course the church was a huge influence on the shaping of early Ireland. I think it's a shame in a way that when you hear about it, certainly here in the UK, almost every story you hear is a negative one. You know, the Magdalene laundries and the fiddling priests and the da-da-da-da. And my experience was incredibly positive. And yet I wasn't a good child. You know, I wasn't a holier-than-thou child. I was really naughty. I was always in trouble. I was expelled from Laurel Hill Convent in Limerick and sent to Ross Gray, which is a boarding school.
But for being was that nuns? You were talking about nuns, was there, it?
Nobody wasn't taught by nuns.
Oh, okay.
That's what I mean. I mean, there may have been schools like that, but I wasn't aware of them. Yeah. Everybody went to one church school or another.
Yeah.
Christian Brothers and the Jesuits for the boys and the Salesians and the, you know, Sisters of Mercy and the da-da-da-da, you know.
Okay, come on then. Why was you expelled? Was it,
I don't even remember. I think I just, how do I put it? I think I've always been rebellious. One of my, I'm happy to share a little bit later about some of my difficulties with relationships and partners. And that comes out of this fierce drive to not allow anyone to tell me what to do.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know why one person is a really good, well-behaved person and somebody else isn't. I don't know. All I know is that it was so much my nature from the beginning. I was a tomboy. I only had brothers. I never had another sister.
Yeah.
And because we were kind of feral, my birthday is the 30th of April, so it's in a few days. And that was May Eve. And in Ireland, that's Beltane, which is a massive festival. Yeah. It's like bigger than Guy Fawkes.
Yeah.
So when I was very small, I thought they were celebrating my birthday.
Could have been.
I got a right shock when I realised it wasn't for me.
We're going to have to play another song. But what I wanted to do, I think we've had a sad week here, Nitt. A mutual friend of ours and a very good friend of mine, Annie Naylor, passed away on Sunday. So I think this would be a good song to dedicate to her, if that's okay.
That would be beautiful.
Can you introduce it?
It's an unusual song when you see the rest of my choices. It's a hymn called Hail Queen of Heaven, the ocean star, guide of the wanderer here below. It's called Hail Queen of Heaven. And it's reminiscent of my positive experience being raised by the nuns and the sense I have always had of being taken care of, always being watched over, always having a guide, no matter where I wandered or what I did or how much I deserved it or not.
Beautiful there, yeah. For Annie, yeah. And you, Yeah, and it means so much to you as well, that song, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I went to Rome a few years ago and they were singing it in St. Peter's and in multiple languages, so in waves, so that people would sing a verse in one language and then another and then another and then another. And everyone was holding these tiny little, you know, the kind of candles you get in Eastern Europe, which they really smell. And it just, I cried. It was so beautiful.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't understand some of the languages. I knew the Latin, Stella Maris, but... yeah, there's just something about ritual and the importance of it in our lives and the fact that we have so little now that has been able to replace it. I think that's partly why I love music, because when you go to big gigs and big concerts and big, I suppose for some people the equivalent would be football, you know,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
But you're part of something bigger than yourself.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That seems to be, to us humans, really important.
Yeah.
You know, you're not an atomized individual. You're part of something greater.
Is it okay to ask you about your relationship with the church now, how you feel about it? Or...
Yeah, I wandered off for a long time. When I left Ireland and went to live in London, which was late 70s, I was definitely not a fan.
Yeah.
I had fallen out. I think, like a lot of things that you're very idealistic about as a child, if you feel like it's let you down in some way, or you feel like you've been betrayed, or you feel like... it's hypocritical and it doesn't mean what it says. I think I hit a point in time where the church itself, the one I was part of, was very inclusive. Pope John had done Vatican II.
Yeah, yeah.
It was all liberal. We used to sing with a guitar in the church. Nice. Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind, The Times They Are Changing. You know, it just felt liberal and progressive and inclusive and lots of interfaith stuff, lots of kindness and compassion, you know, leading up to Live Aid and leading up to, you know, we felt like we were going to save the world in some way.
The world, yeah.
And then the reality of, I don't know, the 1974, 72, 3-4 oil crisis. My dad's business went bankrupt spectacularly. All the heroes that I'd had when I was younger, John F. Kennedy got shot, Martin Luther got shot, Robert Kennedy with that amazing speech about we know the value of the cost of everything and the value of nothing, you know, they got shot. All the heroes were being toppled, and even the songs were changing. And the, you know, the 60s had been Make Peace, Not War, and most beautiful singing and about love and transformation. And Northern Ireland had kicked off. Suddenly everything got dark.
Yeah.
And
so the times have changed, but not for the better. Yeah.
No. And I think you feel it, like youngsters will be now, more acutely when you're just at the start of your adult life. You know, you expected it to be like this and instead it's like this. You just feel betrayed. So the establishment and the institutions and the... so I became quite anarchic. So I left. Also, I had some personal issues with... I had a health problem when I was 18. I got a burst appendix and almost died. So I was in hospital for months.
Right.
I woke up out of that kind of feeling very different. And then I did badly in trying to graduate. And I had been really clever and I was always getting A's and B's and suddenly I wasn't. And I had a relationship breakdown and it got dark. And
So you went to London. Is that kind of all culminated in you going to London, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of fled to London. But then when I got there, it was so exciting.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, for a little girl from the sticks, I know Limerick might sound like a city. But
how old were you went to
I
London?
Was 19 when I first went, but I was 21 when I stayed. I'm trying to think, 77, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, 77.
So it was all going on. Punk would have been big.
Oh, then, my God, yeah. Yeah, arrived in 77. There's a poem by... an Irish poet whose name escapes me. Oh, Kinsella, Thomas Kinsella. And it says, the words are Murphy, isolate, chalk white comedian. And it's about an Irish emigrant arriving in London off the mail boat from Holyhead. And that's exactly how I felt. I arrived in Euston at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning with the birds singing in Euston. It was May, I think. I'd just finished uni and I was on my own. And all I had was an address in a squat in Stoke Newington.
Yeah.
That was a friend of a friend of my brother's. Like, wow. It was so random. And I was like, I went to stay there, and I loved being unknown.
Yeah.
I suppose I'd grown up in such a close that. Community
yeah.
that somehow nobody knowing me
That's it,
was
yeah.
such freedom.
Yeah. Because so in Limerick, everyone would know your business.
Everybody, yeah. especially yeah. our family, because they were really well known. Yeah. It was yeah. so, you know, so you kind of, my mother was always going, oh, God, I'm ashamed of you, you know, and I wouldn't have done anything but worn, you know, tuck my skirt up too far or, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I think I'm going to be slightly careful how I word this, but I think sensuality and girls becoming women in those days was quite challenging.
Yeah.
It was, there was very little guidance. Because on the one hand, you were influenced by free love and, you know...
Yeah, 60s.
And, just yeah. compassion. And women were raised to be kind to everybody and not to upset people. So if somebody asked you to do something, you said yes because you thought he was right, even if he wasn't. It makes me laugh now when I look backwards and I think, oh, my God. We were so innocent yeah. and so naive. And so, you know, we genuinely... If you've been raised in a boarding school, you are not well-versed in the ways of the world.
Yeah. I could talk to you forever, but why are we doing music too? It's just interrupting our chat, isn't it? But that's the format of the show. No, we better do another song if that's okay.
So I got to London and I fell in love with music, which was reggae, punk. I went to every concert you can imagine, you know, with the Rainbow in Camden, yeah. Aswad, and loads of original music. And the other thing I fell in love with was food. I had never eaten anything like it. Just food and music. That's me. Sum me up, food and music. And I ran out of money. So yeah. I was supposed to be on a tour around Europe, but I ran out of money. So I had to get a job. And once I got a job, the joy of actually having your own money, it would just...
Yeah.
I liked the independence. So I went back home for a few months, but I realised I needed to go again. So there I was. So this next song is an English woman, but she speaks to the heart of kind of a lot of why I left Ireland and what I saw around me in the disillusionment of people's daily lives.
Yeah. So it's the Ballad of Lucy Jordan by Marianne Faithfull.
Yeah. where she climbed when all the laughter grew too loud. And she bowed and curtsied to the man who reached and offered her his hand. And he led her down to the long white car that waited past the at the age of 37, she knew she'd found forever as she rode along through Paris with a warm wind in her
That's great. The Ballad of Lucy Jordan, Marianne Faithfull. I'm a big fan of Marianne Faithfull. She's great. She's great. Great singing.
And sadly, just died in January.
Yeah, no, very, very sad. Yeah. So if you just joined us, it's Deserted Island Discs. It's a weekly show where we get people born in Ireland, now living in the Sheffield region, come on and talk about their lives and pick some songs to get us through it. So tonight we've got Yvonne O'Donovan, who's been amazing. We're going to run out of time, aren't we? An hour's not long enough for this woman. So we might get you back in a few months and do part two. But OK, let's pick up. Where are we? We're in London.
Yeah, we're in London. I'm like one of those movies, you know, where people arrive with a suitcase in New York and Broadway and they're looking around and singing a song about being in the big smoke. Yeah. Honestly, I was like a little kid. The red buses, the blokes still wearing bowler hats and pinstripes in the city. It was extraordinary experience for me. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And but I also decided that if I was going to be... I mean, I originally arrived and lived with the Irish in a squat, and it was a bit of a joke. Like, you could do very little and just, you know, people were builders or they were, you know, nobody was very ambitious. Nobody was very anything. But it kind of wasn't enough for me.
Yeah.
I wanted, if I was going to be in a city, I wanted to thrive in it and prosper in it. And so I started out doing jobs, but they weren't senior enough. And I didn't realise I was ambitious until I started working. But I suppose with my background where everybody had run their own businesses, yeah, it was just probably inevitable. So what I did was I did three things in one day and was exhausted. I cleaned offices in the morning to raise extra money. And then I worked in an oil company, sustainable green friends, I did for my sins, but only for 2 years. And then in a shipping company. And while I was doing that, I did a 3 nights a week at the City of London Poly, which is now a university, and got a certified diploma in accounting and finance, which basically allows me to be an associate member of the ACCA. So I was able to get more senior jobs because it was a postgrad diploma. And so then I was doing assistant head office accounting jobs.
Yeah.
I looked like a little air hostess with my shoes, and my parents started speaking to me again. And I was respectable. I hadn't gone too wild.
Well, you had that ambition then, wasn't it? You're obviously quite driven, really, at a young age, too. Because you got really senior in that position, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And then, actually, funnily enough, it was Dermot Hurley, a friend from Corbally, the estate where I grew up in Limerick. I met him in the street, a zebra crossing, honestly, in Camden. And he said he was leaving a job as finance director of the Photographers' Gallery, and would I go and interview for it?
Yeah.
And I didn't want it because it was half the salary, because the arts are not as well paid as big international corporate.
Yeah.
And but he convinced me, so I went along and I got a walk to the interview, so I got the job, and that was how I ended up in arts and culture.
Yeah.
And I was so happy. It was the most exciting thing and the most exciting place I could ever have been. I had a female boss, Sue Davis, who was absolute inspiration.
Yeah.
And we put on exhibitions about climate change with Sting way back in the day, Catherine Hammett. We did anti-apartheid stuff. We did just phenomenal. Most of the famous photographers you would know now were either on the board or exhibiting. So wow. It opened this completely new world to me. The board was all Lord this and Lady that.
You were there brought in to do the finance, really.
But also, on. I mean, there was, I was the only one there that wasn't, hadn't come from a cultural background.
Okay.
So I did personnel, I did finance, I did setting up ways of paying artists, I did royalties, I ran a bookshop, I ran a cafe. I wrote massive funding bids to the Greater London Council, Ken Livingstone, do you remember, before Maggie Thatcher shot him down? The Arts Council, I was on the Charity Finance Directors Group. Eventually we raised enough sponsorship to buy the building in Great Newport Street in near Leicester Square in London, which was no small feat.
Well, yeah.
We even did fundraising in Harrods.
It
was very exciting for a little girl from Corbally.
I mean, that'd have been millions back then, was it?
It was millions.
So.
But Covent Garden was very enlightened. They wanted to redevelop and regenerate the area, but they wanted to make sure they kept people living. So you had to have flats and people living above.
Okay.
And then you could be galleries and shops and, you know, pubs and all the rest underneath, which that kind of mixed use is very inspiring.
Yeah.
Sadly, nowadays, you probably can't do a lot of that because people complain about the noise.
Yeah.
I keep thinking, cities all over the world have vibrant city centres. If you wanted to be quiet, go and live in the suburbs. I have quite strong opinions about that. But, I adored that job. I met my husband, who later became my husband and later became not my husband. But we were together for 17 years and had three children. A girl called Anya in 1982, boy called Liam in 1985, and a boy called Sean in 1986.
Yeah.
Sadly, I lost we lost our son Liam 6 months after he was born from sudden infant death syndrome. No idea why. I keep coming back to tragedy. There's been an underlying sense of loss in the middle of all the gains in my life. You know, it's full of joy, but it's also got this sense of everything is temporary. And in the end, we lose everything. We lose our own lives. We lose everyone we love.
Yeah.
And that's just brought home to me by my own experience.
Yeah.
And but it doesn't take any grief. Doesn't have to be mind-numbing, because you can use it like fertilizer. Your tears become the thing that transforms the next stage, and you appreciate every day so much more if you think everything can just change in the drop of an eye, or the you know, in a second, in a millisecond, everything we see and we think is real can just vanish. So
that's a nice way of looking at it. I mean, it's particularly poignant for us this week and things going on, but it's a good way.
I think it's also like I had seen my own family prosper and then everything disappear. Like that big farm I was going on about became derelict because it just nobody wanted to work it, because that's what people do. They leave the land because the work's too hard and they go and work in the city. My dad's business failed because of the oil crisis in the 70s. You know, look at what's happened to economics since, in terms of things happen to people and they're totally out of their control. And it's not because they've done something wrong or they've made a mistake.
Yeah,
it's just blown up in the face. So I think what it gave me was a sense of, I don't know how you'd put it, almost like someone once described me as someone who keeps getting hit, but then they have a round bottom, so they keep bobbing back up again. It's like some indomitable, like you can put me down, but I'll get back up again. And
so I'm going to have to drag you back to music. So during this time in London, you were going to gigs, and one of the bands you wanted to play, which we haven't got time for now, was Killing Joke. So that was a kind of punky band.
Yeah, it's because that was how I met my husband, Adam.
Right.
And it kind of demonstrates a side of me that it would be easy not to recognise from some of the other song choices how... I suppose blessed part of my upbringing was, you know, it wasn't in dire poverty. It wasn't in, you know, trauma. It wasn't in, it had challenges, but they were kind of in an atmosphere of love and in an atmosphere of people caring for each other and in a, you know, huge extended family of, just care. And this was like throwing punk. I mean, people who loved me, especially in my family, were outraged because, you know, they were drug-taking, beer-swilling, screaming at the world.
Yeah,
but there is a bit of that laced through You know, there is you. There is the rage yeah. as well as the joy. So yeah. there, maybe one is inseparable from the other.
Yeah. Well, kind of connected to that, that kind of Irish punk bit was the Pogues, wasn't it? So
yeah.
we are going to play a Pogue song.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've got, should we, do you want to say something about
it? Well, that? I thought it was very, I watched, God, Everyone Seems to Be Dead. I watched Shane McGowan's Shane, yeah. funeral.
Yeah.
Not that long ago on no. YouTube, and his wife made this amazing speech. But what was interesting was it was the nearest church to where my mother's family farm was, although they were up in the hills and they wouldn't have been their local church, but Nina was the local market town.
Yeah.
And so they would have known it well. It's the St. Mary of the Rosary Church in Nina.
Yeah.
And if you watch that, it's a fantastic example of the Catholic Church behaving well.
Yeah.
How they handled the fact that it would have been, you know, in another church it would have been banned because it was so crazy and so wild and so kind of, you know, acknowledging Shane's addictions and all the other stuff, but yeah. alongside his phenomenal talent as a lyricist and a poet and a performer. So I loved that. It kind of brought the yeah, different strands back together.
It was beautiful sedimentary once, so they did well. They did well playing all that music. So we're going to play Fairy Tale of New York. And here it is.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank. An old man said to me, won't see another one. And then he sang a song, the rare old mountain tune. I turned my face away and dreamed about you. Got on a lucky one, came in 18 to 1. I've got a feeling this year's for me and you. So happy Christmas, I love you, baby. I can see a better time when all our dreams come true.
You promised me Broadway was waiting for me. You were handsome,
you were pretty queen of New York City.
When the band finished playing, they held out for more. Sinatra was swinging, all the junk they were singing. We kissed on the corner, then danced through the night. The boys of the NYPD choir were singing, go away, babe. And the bells were ringing out for Christmas Day.
Dripping that boat.
You scumbag, you maggot, you cheap, lousy faggot. Happy Christmas, you're ours, I pray God it's our love.
The boys of the NYPD choir still singing, go away, babe. And the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.
Could have been someone.
Well, so could anyone. You took my dreams from me when I first found you.
I kept them with me, babe. I put them with my own. Can't make it all alone. I built my dreams around you.
The boys of the NYPD chorus to sing. And the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.
Oh, that's a good one. It's not even Christmas.
No, it's kind of ironic in April.
It's
that combination of Celtic punk. It kind of pulls the two strands of me together.
Yeah, that's great.
And it, just don't forget, through all this, I had nothing to do with churches. I actually had nothing to do with the Irish community, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, I might have gone to the National Ballroom a couple of times in 10 years for a Cayley dance, but that was about it.
Yeah.
It was very international, very global, very mixed race, very, you know, everything under the sun. It was kind of not cool or trendy to have anything to do with organised anything, really.
Yeah.
But don't forget the background to this. I got prosperity. I bought a flat in Kensal Rise, then moved to Crouch End, but just the bottom of Highgate, Hornsey area.
I know London that bit, yeah. It's
but
nice.
In the meantime, we're going from the early 80s to the 1989, so that decade.
Yeah.
You've got riots at Broadwater Farm, which is only around the corner.
Yeah.
You've got the miners' strike here. You've got Thatcher's Britain, civil unrest, Greenham Common. You've got...
Yeah,
you know,
a lot of politics.
And actually, I kind of had, aside from the, what I call the glitterati arts people in London, not much to do with it.
Yeah.
Like, I was kind of stepping over reality, really.
So when I first met you, said you had three sections of your life, really. But I mean, I suppose a big part of your life has been music. Do you want to talk a bit about kind of how you got into that kind of as a... Well, yes, how it became a bigger part of your life.
Yeah, so the reason I was going to put a Killing Joke song in isn't because I particularly love punk. It's because I met my husband and he was running a label called Malicious Damage, which was managing punk bands.
Right.
And one of them was Killing Joke. So
yeah.
I always remember Jazz Coleman, who was the frontman in Killing Joke, told Adam not to marry me because I was too straight.
Right.
And actually, and deep down, that's probably true because I've always tried to keep one leg in what I'd call, you know, respectability and normal society. But there's a part of me that disagrees with how some of normal society is organised.
Yeah.
So I want to rebel. So in a way, maybe I projected my rebellion onto my partners,
yeah.
But or my music taste or whatever. I'm not sure, but it was like so the reason we moved to Sheffield in 1989, which was a weird year to move because it was the year of the Hillsborough disaster. It was the year of the student games and the council going into hock. But it was famous, Sheffield, at those days, not only for losing its steel industry, but for trying to revive it through culture and creative industries.
Yeah.
Remember all the headlines, Rock on the Rates, and, you know, the start of Red Tape. And the council had a scheme then. There was a very enlightened guy called Paul Skelton who worked for Bob Kerslake, was chief exec then. And they had an economic development department that picked industrial strategies around particular industries, and this was one of them.
Yeah.
And that's actually why you're sat in this building, because it was that policy that developed.
That's it. We're down at the workstation,
So we were actually interviewed by Human League to see if we were cool enough to move in
into this building.
Into this building.
Oh, wow.
There's I won't go on about the musical history already here in Sheffield because many of your listeners will know. But for us, it made sense to move into an area that had that.
Yeah.
And we were next door to what later became Warp with Steve and Rob. And
yeah,
we were next to Nation Records, and we were next to, you know, all that.
So can we introduce your next song, okay?
Yeah, so the next song is the one that our record label, Modo, which was, my husband was called Morris and I was called O'Donovan, so Modo is Morris and O'Donovan.
It's one of my favourites too. It's Little Fluffy Clouds by The Orb.
Over the past few years, to the traditional sounds of English summer, the drone of lawnmowers, the smack of leather on willow, has been added a new noise.
What were the skies like when you were young?
They went on forever. We lived in Arizona, and the skies always had little fluffy clouds in them, and they were long and clear. There were lots of stars at night. And when it would rain, they were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were purple and red and yellow and on fire, and the clouds would catch the colors everywhere. That's neat, because I used to look at them all the time when I was little. You don't see that. and when it would rain, it would all turn. They were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were.
Song, it's one of my favorites. If I did this show, that would definitely be on it as well. Yeah, it was probably an album that changed my life, that Yvonne, back in the 90s. So yeah,
sadly it started out inspirational, and like a lot of music industry partnerships, actually social enterprises and cultural partnerships of all kind, there's so much passion in them. Sometimes the passion implodes and it all ends up spattered across the carpet.
Okay.
So, yeah, I cannot believe that at this point I've got to the mid-90s and it's now 2025. I don't think I can get through the rest of my life in 5 minutes.
No, we're going to have to invite you back, Yvonne. It's gone so quickly. It's been absolutely lovely. But we do have about 3 minutes left, which I've gotten to know you so far. That's probably enough time for you just to talk. So is there anything more you want to say? I think we should kind of focus on probably where you're at now and what.
Yeah, I think it would be remiss. There was a bit where after that music industry situation ended with some acrimony, and I had a tough period without much support and ended up actually temporarily homeless, and I kind of had to dig myself out of a hole and start all over again. So I then had a relationship, I had another lovely child called Neve,
right.
And then two grandchildren.
Yeah.
And then I set up a company called Inspiral, which went on for about 7 years. Which used initially Arts Council money, but later European structural funding money, and to raise the cultural profile of arts and digital industries here in across South Yorkshire, actually. So we funded. I was looking at the client list earlier. Couldn't believe how many people, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of people, that we managed to get grants to and business support to, and that a lot of them still thriving, so it makes me very proud.
Yeah.
And then after that phase, which was took me up to 2005, again there was a bit of a hiccup, as often happens in my life, and I came back into work again with a focus on agriculture, because I'd been involved with the Hugh, who set up Nether Edge Farmers Market, and with some of the other growers and sustainability people in the city, using a community enterprise to raise money. I'm a good fundraiser.
Yeah.
I think I worked out I have raised 80 million in my career.
Wow, that's not
unfortunately
bad,
not much of it stuck, because it was all for other projects.
Well, no, that's amazing.
But it's astonishing when you look at the seeds dotted everywhere that became something else, that then became something else, that then became something else.
Yeah.
So I went to work for the School of Artisan Food in Nottinghamshire, and I did that for nearly 15 years up until last year.
Yeah.
And also lecturing in Nottingham Trent Uni. So that was to help food businesses who are initial primary producers, so cheese and charcuterie and bakers, and many of whom are here in Sheffield, but they're also right across the world.
You're saying how much you've helped, like that kind of grassroots food stuff, and that's why Sheffield, people saying that Sheffield's food's like amazing, and all that's down to you.
Well, I think the twin pillars of every civilization is culture and agriculture. So, you know, if you get those two things right, how you feed yourself and how you feed your body and how you feed your soul, you're sorted as a civilization. So they're the most important things you can be doing.
That's a lovely way to end. Thank you, Yvonne O'Donovan.